Good morning. Supreme Court justices had tough questions about President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs. What happens if the court rules against the president's use of emergency powers? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A federal judge in Chicago says an immigration processing facility seems more like a prison. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. His order to improve conditions there is the latest win in Chicago courts against Trump's immigration policy. Also, is there any end in sight for the national redistricting battle after California's Prop 50 passed? And what data centers could do to help control everyone's rising electricity costs? It's Thursday, November 6th. On this day in 1947, the longest-running TV show in the U.S. debuted, NBC's Meet the Press. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The federal government shutdown is now 37 days old, and it is affecting air traffic. The Federal Aviation Administration says starting tomorrow, it's going to reduce air traffic by 10% in the 40 busiest markets. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford.
We have decided that a 10% reduction in scheduled capacity would be appropriate to, again, continue to take the pressure off of our controllers. And as we continue to see staffing triggers, there will be additional measures that will be taken in those specific markets.
The shutdown is also cutting into federal food assistance. The Trump administration says it will pay out half the amount of people's typically monthly benefit during November. But a new study says most eligible people will likely get less than that, and millions of recipients won't get anything at all. President Trump says this week's poor election results for Republicans are due to the shutdown. He wants GOP senators to get rid of the chamber's filibuster to end the shutdown. That Senate rule requires 60 votes to pass most legislation. GOP senators oppose this. Maine Democratic Congressman Jared Golden says he is abandoning his re-election bid. He's pointing to hyper-partisanship and a dysfunctional Congress. Steve Missler of member station Maine Public has more.
Golden made the announcement in a column published in the Bangor Daily News, in which he lamented the increasing hostility in the nation's politics and threats against him and his family. He also criticized what he described as the pugilistic voices taking control of the Democratic Party, comparing it to the Tea Party movement. Golden has been under fire by fellow Democrats for his sparing criticism of President Donald Trump and critiques of his own party. He drew a primary challenger in former Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap. Golden wrote that he wasn't afraid of losing, but dreaded the prospect of winning. He's managed to hold the second congressional district seat since 2019, despite the district's increasingly rightward turn in recent years. For NPR News, I'm Steve Missler in Augusta, Maine.
Pope Leo is speaking about the treatment of migrants in the U.S. NPR's Jason DeRose reports he says immigration authorities must respect the spiritual rights of those held in detention.
Pope Leo spoke to a group of reporters just outside Rome and expressed concern about the mass arrests and deportations taking place in the United States under the Trump administration. To underscore his point, Leo referred to a passage from the Gospel of Matthew heard in many Catholic churches recently.
Jesus says very clearly, at the end of the world, we're going to be asked, how did you receive the foreigner? Did you receive him and welcome him? Or not.
The Pope was specifically responding to immigration authorities not allowing migrants arrested in Chicago to receive Holy Communion. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves says there's been an explosion at a chemical plant near Yazoo City in central Mississippi. He says this caused an ammonia leak. The governor says emergency teams are responding and that no injuries have been reported. The president of the Philippines has declared a state of emergency after a powerful typhoon ravaged the country's central provinces. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the storm killed at least 114 people and left around 100 others missing.
President Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s declaration of emergency is intended to speed up relief efforts, disbursement of government funds, and allow price controls on basic goods. Typhoon Kalmeggi dumped a month and a half's rainfall on Cebu City in one day, causing severe flooding. More than 2 million people were affected and more than 500,000 residents were displaced. The dead include 6 people killed when an Air Force helicopter on a relief mission crashed on the island of Mindanao. Even as authorities grapple with the effects of Typhoon Kalmagi, they're preparing for the arrival of another powerful typhoon in the country's north early next week. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
The Maldives says it is now the first country to ban smoking for an entire generation of people. The South Asian island country's new law says that anyone born in 2007 or later, that's about 18 years old, cannot buy or use tobacco products in the Maldives ever. They will never be legally permitted to smoke there, even when they get older. This law also applies to tourists. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Nuremberg, a new thriller starring Russell Crowe, Rami Malek, and Michael Shannon about the historic post-World War II trial of Nazi official Hermann Göring. Starts Friday in theaters.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
In 1913, Lake Superior unleashed a ferocious tempest. Winds roared at speeds exceeding 90 miles an hour, creating waves that towered up to 35 feet high, swallowing any ship that dared to sail. Over the course of four devastating days, this colossal storm wreaked havoc, sinking a total of 19 ships on Lake Superior alone, claiming more than 250 lives. In Duluth, the heart of Minnesota's shoreline, the storm's impact was catastrophic. Roofs were torn from houses, streets were submerged under 10 feet of water, and railroad tracks were washed away. The toll on the fishing industry was equally severe. Over 50 fishing boats were lost, along with countless nets and traps, crippling a vital source of livelihood for our coastal communities. As the skies finally cleared, survivors faced the daunting task of rebuilding homes and livelihoods. The 1913 Great Lakes Storm remains one of the most devastating natural disasters in Minnesota's history.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Federal regulators are cutting air traffic at 40 major airports starting tomorrow because of the shutdown. In a few minutes, we'll hear what that could mean for Thanksgiving travel. But first,
the Supreme Court has not yet issued a major ruling against President Trump in his second term.
They heard arguments yesterday in a case about Trump's tariffs. We don't know yet what the opinion will say, but the justices' questions yesterday, including from conservatives, were skeptical of Trump's positions.
NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben was listening. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning.
Okay, so just recap for us. What were these arguments about?
Well, they were about the law that Trump used to impose those tariffs you mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's a 1977 law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. And it gives a president broad economic powers during an emergency. So in this case, you had a group of businesses and states arguing that that law does not give the president the power to impose these tariffs. In fact, they noted that IEEPA doesn't even contain the word tariffs.
Okay, so what was the administration arguing here?
Well, there's a key phrase in IEEPA that was central to the arguments. That law says a president can, quote, regulate imports. Solicitor General John Sauer said that allows a president to tariff because, he argued, tariffs are simply a basic way to regulate imports. But that connected then to a bigger constitutional question, whether in the process of regulating imports, the president is allowed to tax because the Constitution gives Congress the power to raise revenue. And this led to a lot of questions about what the president can and can't do. Justice Kavanaugh at one point suggested that he didn't think that Congress intended to create what he called a donut hole. That is, he didn't think they meant to allow a president to regulate imports using, say, sweeping embargoes, but not to impose even a minimal tariff. And here we're going to hear him talking to Benjamin Gutman, one of the lawyers challenging the tariffs.
That doesn't seem, but I want to get your answer, to have a lot of common sense behind it.
I think it absolutely does because it's a fundamentally different power. It's not a donut hole. It's a different kind of pastry.
That got laughter in the courtroom and even got a chuckle out of Kavanaugh. But what Gutman was saying was that this is about types of powers, that the law gives the president broad powers, but that that simply doesn't include tariffs.
So not about pastries then, Danielle.
Right.
What sense did you get? I mean, you watched this a lot more closely than I did, of how the justices felt about these arguments.
Well, as you said, there was some skepticism. The more liberal justices were definitely more open to the arguments against the tariffs. But even some more conservative justices seemed skeptical of the government's arguments. Justice Gorsuch was especially concerned about whether Congress was delegating one of its core jobs to the president here and whether that's even allowed.
What would prohibit Congress from just abdicating all responsibility to regulate foreign commerce, for that matter, declare war, to the president?
We don't contend that he could do that. If it did,
why not?
Well, because we're dealing with a statute again that has a whole.
I'm not asking about the statute, General. I'm not asking about the statute. I'm asking for your theory of the Constitution.
And there were a few exchanges like that with Gorsuch really poking at Sauer's rationale.
And what happens if they decide against the president?
Well, on tariffs, the ultimate effect is unclear. I mean, a bunch of his tariffs would then be illegal, but other tariffs, like the ones he's imposed on particular goods, like steel and aluminum, those would remain, and he could use other laws to impose more. Now, as for Trump himself, he has called this the most important Supreme Court case ever. So, yeah, he'd be upset. But also importantly, we would be seeing this court trying to meaningfully rein in his power. So we would see what comes of that. And a ruling is expected by July.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's dive deeper with this with Amy Howe. She's the co-founder and primary reporter for SCOTUS blog. So, Amy, what did you observe about the questions that the justices asked yesterday?
The justices, it was interesting because when the lower court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, heard this case, they did not divide on necessarily on ideological lines. The dissent in that case, which would have upheld the Trump tariffs, was written by an Obama appointee, Judge Richard Toronto. But, you know, as Danielle said, in this case, all three of the court's liberal justices were squarely on board supporting the challengers. And so it's a question of whether or not they can pick up two more votes to strike down the tariffs. And they certainly did seem to have the vote of Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was one of the strongest defenders of the challengers. And, you know, Justice Amy Coney Barrett had some questions that were skeptical. Chief Justice John Roberts also had some questions that seemed to be very skeptical. So it seemed that there was probably a majority to strike down the tariffs.
How malleable is that term, regulate imports?
That is kind of the $64,000 question, you know, both because, you know, including the court's conservative justices, there's long been this principle called textualism, which is the idea that you look at the text of the statute and not what Congress necessarily intended to do when it enacted the statute. And there are arguments on both sides. Justice Barrett, on the one hand, said, you know, to John Sauer, the Solicitor General representing the Trump administration, can you point to any other place in federal law where the term regulate has been used to allow the administration to impose taxes? On the other hand, John Sauer said, you know, tariffs have traditionally been a way for the president to regulate importation. So, you know, on the one hand, perhaps it is somewhat malleable. And then you get into some, you know, somewhat arcane legal doctrines that the Supreme Court has employed, including one called the Major Questions Doctrine, which may or may not be in play here. That's the idea that if Congress wants to give the power to make decisions that have major economic or political significance, it needs to say so really clearly. So it's not enough that this phrase, regulate importation, is malleable. And the Supreme Court relied on this doctrine called the Major Questions Doctrine to strike down several Biden era initiatives, yeah, including the student loan debt relief program, the COVID-19 eviction moratorium, the COVID-19 vaccine mandate. So I think a lot of people are watching this closely to see if, you know, essentially what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Are they going to use the Major Questions Doctrine to strike down the tariffs program as well?
The arcane stuff's the nitty-gritty, Amy. That's the fun stuff, right?
That is the fun stuff. It was the sort of legal nerd Super Bowl yesterday.
Yeah. So if the Supreme Court
say, were to strike down the tariffs, we're talking about like $200 billion in tariffs since April. I mean, what happens to the money? What does Trump have to do with the money?
I mean, that was the question that Justice Barrett had for Neal Katyal, the lawyer representing the small businesses in the case. She said, is this going to be a complete mess? And Neal Katyal's answer was yes. He acknowledged it's complicated, but he said that's not a reason to rule for the challengers. The Supreme Court has said this in other cases. And he gave the justices a variety of options to try to mitigate the impact in terms of the refund process. He said you could put your decision on hold to give, for example, Congress time to act, which sounds like it would be highly unusual, which it is, but it's not unprecedented. The Supreme Court has done that before. Or he said you could say that your ruling only applies going forward so that businesses in the future don't have to pay the tariffs, but the government wouldn't have to deal with the refund issue.
One more thing really quick. What are the chances that whatever ruling we get will speak to the larger issue of executive power, something that the court has not really stopped President Trump from expanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think it you know, by definition, almost certainly will speak to the question of executive power. You know, the question is sort of what issue of executive power, because this is a question of the president, you know, asserting executive power, asserting power that arguably Congress has, the power to tax, but will be also be seen other cases soon in which the president involving, you know, the FTC commissioner has power where he's arguing that Congress has taken away his power.
I'm sorry, I have to leave it there. Amy Howe, co-founder and lead reporter for SCOTUS Blog. Amy, thanks.
Thank you.
Traveling for Thanksgiving is almost always stressful, from bad weather to crowded airports. So will the government shutdown, if it's still happening, make it worse? NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
For most of last month, the shutdown's impact on air travel has been somewhat mild. There have been sporadic delays, yes, but no mass cancellations. That's likely to change, says Katie Nastro, a travel expert from the flight tracking app Going.
What we saw at the end of last week and now into this week is we're starting to see the seams come apart in the way of not just air traffic controller. We're seeing more staffing triggers happen, but we're also seeing TSA lines finally getting impacted.
Tens of thousands of air traffic controllers and TSA agents have been required to work without pay. Last week, the Federal Aviation Administration said it started to see a surge in employee absences. That forced the agency to reduce the number of flights at certain airports to maintain safety, and that in turn caused flight delays and cancellations. On Wednesday, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said airline traffic will be reduced by 10% across 40 locations starting Friday amid staffing issues. Now factor in Thanksgiving weekend, aviation expert William McGee anticipates widespread disruptions and longer TSA lines.
It means that during one of the busiest times of the year, an awful lot of folks are going to get stranded.
Part of the issue is that delays and cancellations don't happen in a vacuum. Instead, they often create a domino effect, impacting other flights and airports. And these days, flights tend to operate near full capacity, leaving fewer available seats for passengers needing to rebook.
That's why we have meltdowns that last not a couple of hours, but sometimes a week.
McGee says flight operations need time to stabilize if they experience disruptions. So mass delays could still be a reality if the federal government reopens too close to Thanksgiving. Despite the uncertainty, Nastro from Going says she still encourages people to keep their travel plans.
I still would say that we are cautiously optimistic that you should still buy your flights.
Her rule of thumb is to pick a nonstop flight and choose early departures. She also recommends buying a ticket that offers flight credits, just in case. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Layla Faldin. California's approval of Proposition 50 let the state's Democratic leadership temporarily replace their congressional map to make it easier for Democrats to win 5 new House seats next year. It was a response to Texas Republicans redrawing their map to give them a similar edge. Joining us to discuss the redistricting race that's going on is Amy Walter. She's publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report, which is a nonpartisan newsletter that analyzes American political trends. Amy, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, I think the big question is, okay, Texas did it, California did it. So what does this mean for other redistricting efforts across the U.S.? Does this keep them going or does it stop them?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think in some ways we've seen a little bit of both.
Okay.
Just the other day in Kansas, a state that was getting a lot of pressure from national Republicans to redraw. There's only one Democratic seat in Kansas to redraw that seat. Republican legislators there said, I don't think so. Now, to be fair, some of that hesitation was coming before the Prop 50 final vote. However, Virginia, a state that is held by Democrats, pushing forward on putting a similar sort of proposition in front of voters in that state coming in 2026. To me, Layla, what stood out the most about the Proposition 50 experience and what it tells us about redistricting going forward was in the exit polls. The exit polls in California asked, do you think that redistricting, we should do it in response to other states? 64% said, no, we really shouldn't do that.
Oh, wow.
They still voted for it. But here's the one that really struck out to
me.
Do you think congressional districts should be drawn by the party in power or a nonpartisan commission? 92% of California voters said, we think that congressional districts should be drawn by the party in, by a nonpartisan commission, which is currently the law in California. 92% said, we'd like that to stay. And yet 63% of them voted to overturn it.
So in this moment, when there is this sort of redistricting plan that will impact the midterms, the voters seem to know they don't want this, but are still in the battle. So where does it go from here? I mean, is this a Pandora's box that's been opened by Trump's push for a mid-decade partisan redistricting here?
It sure feels that way today. And I think we don't know until we see the results of the 2026 election. If Republicans are successful at holding the House, thanks to, in part, shoring up their majority with these new district lines, it may give other, you know, it may give future Congresses or future legislators the sense that, well, maybe this is something we should be thinking about every 2 years. if it's not successful, and I would argue that at the end of the day, the political environment is going to tell us a lot more about who controls Congress than how many lines get drawn in this redistricting battle. So if it's not successful in staving off Democratic success in 2026, and if there are negative consequences, right, where seats that were supposed to flip one way end up going the other, or incumbents who were drawn into different districts end up losing, say, their primaries, there may be more resistance going forward on doing this again.
But what if it is successful? I mean, if one party right. is able to say, to create right. redistricting so another party really can never come back into majority, what does that mean for a two-party system democracy?
Yeah, it means that we are stuck in something of a doom loop, and that the two parties just are looking constantly for any bit of an opportunity, any bit of an edge to get into power. And look, our politics right now is basically calcified. And so the shifts that it takes for one party to gain control or to lose control are on the margins, just a handful of seats, a handful of states, 100,000 votes or so can determine whether you get to be in power or not. Right. And so I think that pressure is going to remain for the near future and maybe the foreseeable future.
Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report, thank you for your time and your insights.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, the Grammy nominations will be announced, and for the first time ever, nominees for Best Album Cover are coming. Did you have any favorites growing up?
Oh my gosh, Layla. Okay, so yeah, Like a Virgin was the first album I ever bought, the Madonna album, her second album. I felt like I was bringing in something like that I shouldn't have been bringing into my house, so I had to hide it from my mom. Doggy Style, Snoop Dogg's really first album. That has a really cool artwork. It gave you kind of a preview of what was to come. From the depths of the sea, back to the black Snoop Doggy Dog, monkey, yes, the dot. And then probably my favorite, Layla, is Dirty Mind, Prince. That was 1980. It's Prince standing there, black and white picture, with a long trench coat and nothing on underneath except for a bandana and bikini bottoms.
Do you still have these albums?
Oh, absolutely do, yeah.
Oh, I don't have any albums I grew up with. I lived in Saudi Arabia as a kid, and I would buy these album covers, but they would look very different for me because at the time, Saudi Arabia would censor everything. So all the Mariah Carey albums that I would buy had her in very modest outfits, and then I'd come to the U.S. and realize, oh, that's not what she was wearing. So we'll find out tomorrow who's nominated for this new category. This is NPR News.
The Colorado River isn't what it was back in 1922 when the last agreement was made on how to divvy up the water among the several states it feeds.
We've got these 19th century laws and 20th century infrastructure and 21st century climate, and those things don't fit together very well.
I'm Elsa Chang. How states are renegotiating their share of the river without federal intervention on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. We are People Powered Radio. Thanks to people like you who listen at 5:30 in the morning and who understand the importance of local media. We sure appreciate it. I'm Heidi Holt and hope you're having a good morning. We would like to thank Sanford Health for their support. Their primary care locations are in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Cloudy today with highs 42 to 49. Southeast winds gusting up to 20. Overnight lows in the low 30s with a slight chance of some mixed precipitation. For tomorrow morning, chance of sprinkles or flurries, cloudy with highs 34 to 41 degrees. We've been gathering stories all this week as folks get ready for the opening of hunting season. It's Minnesota's firearm deer season opener this Saturday. We want to know about your hunting traditions or the stories that you have to share. Text us 218-326-1234. It's going to be a big night for green cheese when folks call in from their hunting shacks. Maybe that's part of your tradition. Let us know. Text 218-326-1234. Coming up at 9 o'clock today, it's Headwaters, your source for great music. Weekday mornings, 9 to 11, and in the evening from 10 p.m. to midnight. Today it is Spin That Ish, favorite music from the month of October from the KEXC music team. And if you're somebody who loves music, maybe you've always wanted to be a DJ, we do have opportunities coming up next week, Wednesday, November 12th at KEXC, or the next night in Bemidji. Both classes run from 5:30 to 7. You can email volunteer at kaxe.org. It's time now for our Daily Dose of Nature. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, November 6th, 1999, I'm saddened to discover that the eagle's nest has fallen to the ground. The white pine that supported it had been scarred by a porcupine's, and the top had died, and finally, the nest fell. It was built in 1985, and it lasted until this November 1999. I was dismayed because I saw this as the end of a chance to have an eagle as a neighbor, but I was mistaken because just 1 week later, on the 12th of November, I noticed that they are beginning anew to build a nest in an aspen, which is not far removed from the tree that they had the nest in previously. Having eagles for neighbors is a unique and exciting experience because when they fledge, when the young fledge from the nest, oftentimes they end up in some unpredictable places like on my deck rail or in my yard or on a branch in a tree right near my door. All exciting spots.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Chicagoans opposed to President Donald Trump's aggressive immigration campaign are taking his administration to court and winning so far.
This week, there's been hours of testimony as one federal judge listened to accounts about citizens' jarring encounters with federal agents. And another judge ordered the administration to improve the conditions at an immigration holding facility in a Chicago suburb.
John Seidel with Chicago Public Media and the Chicago Sun-Times has been covering this and is with me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So these legal fights have been going on for over a month. In what ways has the city prevailed?
Well, last month, a federal judge in Chicago ruled against Trump's efforts to deploy National Guard troops here. And another judge limited federal agents' use of force against protesters and required a senior official to actually sit for a lengthy deposition. And now that judge, Sarah Ellis, is preparing to rule on what's called a preliminary injunction. It would basically extend the order she issued last month that governs agents' use of force here.
Well, Judge Ellis held a hearing yesterday in order to make that decision. What was the testimony like?
Yeah, she presided over an eight-hour hearing Wednesday. She heard from a woman who said she found herself staring down the barrel of a gun just for filming the arrest of day laborers. The judge heard from a pastor who said he was shot in the head by pepper balls while praying outside a holding facility. And the judge heard the video testimony of U.S. Border Patrol Commander Greg Bovino, who's become the public face of this campaign. He said the use of force here has been, quote, more than exemplary. And now Judge Ellis says she plans to hand down her ruling today.
Oh, tell us more about Bovino.
Bovino came here from California, where he led Operation At Large. That led to a very controversial ruling by the Supreme Court, which allowed agents in that operation to continue stopping people based on factors like race and language. Bovino was accused last month of throwing tear gas into a crowd in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood without justification. Federal authorities say he did so while being confronted by a hostile mob. They even said he'd been hit in the head with a rock. But attorneys told Judge Ellis yesterday that Bovino finally admitted he threw the tear gas before the rock entered the picture. Bovino's deposition was conducted privately, and we're waiting to see how much of it becomes public.
Now, we mentioned the ruling about an immigration facility. What is happening in that one?
That's right. Judge Robert Gettleman presided over a similar hearing Tuesday. That one revolved around the conditions inside this holding center in suburban Broadview. It's where most people arrested by immigration agents find themselves being held, at least for a short while. Until this summer, the facility hadn't been intended as a long-term holding center. But Gettleman heard that people are being held there for days at a time, 100 to 150 people to a cell. They often have nowhere to sleep but the floor, he was told, and many are sleeping near a dirty toilet. Though it's long been considered a detention or processing center, Judge Gettleman said it seems more like a prison. And Wednesday, he ordered that people held there should all be given clean bedding and a mat, that each holding room should be cleaned at least twice a day, and that everyone should be given adequate supplies of soap, towels, toilet paper, and other hygiene products.
John Seidel with Chicago Public Media and the Chicago Sun-Times. John, thank you for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Utility customers are increasingly getting a shock when they open their electric bill. Power prices are climbing faster than the overall cost of living, leading to lots of frustration. As part of our cost of living series, The Price We Pay, NPR's Scott Horsley finds out what's behind those costly kilowatts.
Now that fall is here, Kathy Latorno no longer has to run her air conditioner around the clock. But the Fort Walton Beach, Florida resident will soon be relying on electric heat to stay warm. The 71-year-old says her power bills run between $200 and $300 a month all year round.
When you're living on a fixed income, you feel it. There's been a few times we couldn't afford it. We've had our lights turned off before.
Residential electric rates in Florida have jumped more than 13% in the last year, according to the Energy Department, and Letourneau is bracing for another increase next year.
Florida is a lot of retired people on Social Security, and I mean, it's hard.
Across the country, residential electric rates are climbing twice as fast as overall inflation. That's partly because natural gas used to generate electricity is more expensive. Growing demand is also testing the power supply. For most of the last two decades, demand for electricity barely budged. But in the last few years, people and businesses have been plugging in more and more. Drew Maloney heads the Edison Electric Institute, which represents utilities.
There's automobiles that have gone from gasoline-powered to electric vehicles. You're also, seeing stoves being replaced from gas to electric, and the AI data center growth.
Utilities are hustling to replace old power plants that have gone out of service and adding new generating capacity from wind, solar, and natural gas.
Look, we support developing all energy sources. We need as many electrons on the grid as possible to help keep the grid reliable and cost low.
Maloney says building new power supplies along with a more resilient electric grid will cost utilities more than $1 trillion over the next 5 years. The question facing regulators is, who's going to pay for that?
Severin Bornstein, who's faculty director at the UC Berkeley Energy Institute, says ideally all those new data centers springing up to support the artificial intelligence boom will cover their own power cost and at least a bit more to help lower the bills for nearby residential customers.
That doesn't seem that hard to do, but you'd be surprised how many politicians and regulators say, well, this is an economic development opportunity. We should give them a great rate. And in their enthusiasm, they will end up charging rates that don't even cover the incremental cost.
If that happens, residential customers could end up saddled with some of the cost of supplying those new data centers. Bornstein says there are ways to cut the nation's overall power bill by adjusting when and where electricity is consumed. By far, the most expensive time to use power is when demand is at its peak, typically on the hottest days of summer when air conditioners are working hardest.
If you could get these data centers to get off the grid, say, 50 to 60 hours a year, they really wouldn't create any cost pressure at all.
Bornstein suggests data centers could do that by temporarily switching to backup power or rerouting their data traffic to cooler parts of the country. He says regulators could require that. Electric vehicle owners also have considerable flexibility in deciding when to plug in and charge. While demand for electricity has picked up in recent years, Bornstein says it grew more than twice as fast in the 1960s. That's when air conditioning was going mainstream, making it comfortable for retirees like Letourneau to live in places like Florida. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
You should give as you are able because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
It's 5:43. More news is coming up next from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. It's here on independent, people-powered KAXE. Thanks so much for being here this morning. We do have more news updates that are coming in to make sure you stay tuned for, including we'll be learning about WNBA contract negotiations. Weather around our region, we are looking at today cloudy skies, highs in the low to upper 40s all across our region. Some things going on this, you can be a part of the Itasca Waters today at noon. They have their free Practical Water Wisdom webinar series. This month, the topic is how invasive freshwater snail species can disrupt ecosystems with Sarah Kingsbury from Fisheries and Oceans Canada. Register at itascawaters.org. Mondays in November, you can take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library, 5 to 6 p.m. You gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. And it is First Friday with lots of arts events all across the region, including Northwood's Friends of the Arts in Cook with Native American art during the month of November, with an opening reception tomorrow night from 5 to 7 o'clock. More news is coming up next.
NPR comes from this station. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. The WNBA is extending its contract with the Players Union because negotiations over a new deal are still ongoing. As the popularity of women's basketball skyrockets, major sticking points include issues such as salaries and revenue sharing. Now, to hear more about what the players are asking for, we've called up Erin Drake. She's the senior legal counsel for the Women's National Basketball Players Association. Erin, so what would you say is the number one issue that the players in the league are most far apart on?
A salary system tied to a meaningful share of the revenue that the players help generate and from the business that they've built.
Yeah, because right now it's, what, about 9% of the revenue of the WNBA goes to the players, and in the NBA it's about 49 to 51%, so NBA players get about half. Is that something that you think can be made up in negotiations by the time next season's supposed to start?
Absolutely. It has to be. The players have been consistent that is their demand. And in fact, that 9% figure is the addition of all the kind of salaries and benefits the players have. But under the current system, the players have been left out of the growth of this business, and they are looking to change that.
Yeah, and growth is definitely something that's happening with the WNBA. Next year, there's supposed to be an 11-year, $2.2 billion media rights deal that's supposed to start. And two new teams, Toronto Tempo and Portland Fire, they're supposed to get underway next year. So clearly the league is growing. But let me ask you this, Erin. I mean, if it comes down to it, I'm wondering, are the players prepared to strike if it comes down to it? Because I saw Sophie Cunningham of the Indiana Fever last month say that she said, I quote, "I promise you, if we aren't going to play until they give us what we deserve." So are the players willing to do a strike?
Over the past year, the players have been consistent. They're at the table. They're doing the hard work. And they know their value. And that value must be reflected in a deal. And I think if a work stoppage were to come to pass, that's going to reflect just how far apart the league and the players remain and the inability to truly value them at their worth.
When it comes to a strike, though, in other leagues, the players seem to take the brunt of the public criticism. Are you concerned that all of the goodwill and fan interest that has been built up, especially over the last few years, might all of a sudden be eroded if the players decide to strike?
No. And part of that is because the public is with us. The fans are with the players. They understand that when they show up at the arena, when they buy jerseys, when they buy ticket sales, when they buy merch, that money does not go to the players, and that is fundamentally wrong. That is fundamentally antithetical to the growth of a business. And the public knows that. The players also know that. And it would be unfortunate if the league continued to act as if that weren't true.
One more thing really quick, Erin, just a few seconds. Is this kind of just what happens when a business grows? I mean, labor situations like this just, you know, are going to occur because, you know, there's more money at stake.
The players are looking to evolve this business. I think you mentioned all that growth. There are also an additional three teams that are coming online between now and the end of the decade. That kind of growth can't survive in the system that currently exists, and it must change.
That's Erin Drake, senior legal counsel for the WNBA Players Association. Thank you very much, Erin.
Thanks.
And the WNBA told us in a statement they've been negotiating in good faith, and their top priority is getting a deal that, quote, addresses players' ask for significant increases in pay and benefits while ensuring the long-term growth and success of the league. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234 or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
Pride in the highest of courts.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Good morning to you. U.S. Supreme Court justices yesterday heard the arguments and asked questions about whether an emergency powers law from back when disco was first hitting the charts can be used by a president to overhaul international trade, plus bring in lots of money through import taxes without getting Congress to go along. Jess Braven, Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, listened to every word. Jess, welcome back.
Good morning.
I mean, that wasn't speed dating. It is the job of high court justices to ask tough questions, which they did. That said, what do you think was the vibe? Were justices buying what the administration side was selling?
No, they weren't. And it was interesting to hear them talk about it because, you know, we've been going for months with a bunch of unexplained emergency orders that have largely gone the administration's way. So to hear the justices grilling Solicitor General John Sauer and really having skeptical questions about the administration's position was a reminder that the Supreme Court does take these cases one by one, and it's not a slam dunk, even for a president who has gotten so far pretty much everything he's asked for.
All right. So many issues on the table during that session. Let's listen to two justices, the Chief Justice as well as Justice Sotomayor, on a similar subject. Here's John Roberts.
The vehicle is imposition of taxes on Americans, and that has always been the core power of Congress.
And Sotomayor?
I just don't understand this argument. It's not an article. It's a congressional power, not a presidential power to tax. And you want to say tariffs are not taxes, but that's exactly what they are.
Now, Jess, this is important, right? Because you know, we learn in civics class that Congress has the taxing power in America.
And this was really, the most telling thing for the administration's chances, was trying to characterize tariffs as a diplomatic measure, a foreign policy measure that the government can use, or the president can use, to pressure other countries to see things Washington's way. But the Supreme Court accepted the challenger's view that taxes are different. There may be all kinds of things that the president can do, some things more severe than tariffs, like perhaps a complete trade embargo. But taxes are different because they are about raising revenue. John Sauer insisted that raising revenue was not the point of these tariffs.
All right. And this was not just about tariffs, about trade policy, or about taxation. Let's listen to Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Congress is a practical matter. Can't get this power back once it's handed it over to the president. It's a one-way ratchet toward the gradual but continual accretion of power. in the executive branch and away from the people's elected representatives.
I mean, at the heart of this, that's why so many people are paying attention, not just to figure out, you know, how much it's going to cost to import something, right?
Well, that is right, because, you know, we know that President Trump has a very expansive view of his own powers. But leaving Trump even out of it, Justice Gorsuch was talking about a kind of structural reality. It was even explained by in one of the Friend of the Court briefs filed by a law professor, saying that if Congress is delegating its taxing power, and incidentally, even the government did not dispute that taxing is a congressional power. They just argued that under the language of the 1977 law the president invoked, Congress had delegated this authority to the president.
Jess Braven, Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Hey, my pleasure, David.
Checking the numbers, Dow futures are flat at the moment. S&P and NASDAQ futures are both up by a tenth of a percent. Bonds are up, easing the benchmark 10-year interest rate slightly, down at 4.13%. Crude oil up half a percent right now, just under $60 a barrel in New York. Now, if you have a flight starting tomorrow, note the Trump administration is now warning they'll be cutting flights by 10% at many airports to ease congestion if the government is still shut down with air traffic control towers short-staffed. Keep your airline's app in the foreground, right?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, designed to secure passwords from any location on any device this holiday season. Available at bitwarden.com. And by Wealth Enhancement, offering its Wealth Blueprint, a plan integrating retirement, investing, tax strategies, and more. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/blueprint.
The Trump administration says it is working to comply with a court order to pay some food stamp benefits as soon as it can, despite the current government shutdown. With these SNAP benefits interrupted, you can now see the predicted effects at food banks in Texas, Colorado, Utah, and beyond. Marketplace's Nova Safo visited a food aid distribution operation in Fresno, California's agricultural heartland.
The line to get into the food bank is hundreds of people long, snaking along the sidewalk.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
Stephanie Winninger, coordinator with the Central California Food Bank, is passing out laminated cards with numbers on them. It's a first-come, first-served system.
When I got here this morning at 7, the line was already wrapped around the corner. Usually, it wouldn't even hit the corner yet before the shutdown.
Within 5 minutes, she's run out of cards to give out. There are at least 100 more people in line. It's unclear whether they'll get in to get food. Among those who did make it in is 39-year-old Brandon Holm. He says he's a self-employed tattoo artist and depends on SNAP, and he's at the food bank for the first time.
We're only able to get 15 items today. I don't know how long that 15 items is gonna last, and then I don't know when the SNAP benefits are actually gonna come through, and so I'm gonna end up having to look for more food resources.
Sitting nearby, sipping coffee and waiting for their turn to pick up food, are Maria Eva Romero and Felipe Cruz. They're 81 and 73, respectively.
Venimos a que nos den comida porque no tenemos.
They say they're out of food and here because they didn't get their SNAP benefits. I ask them what they'll do if SNAP remains cut off for weeks.
Pues si nos dejan trabajar, trabajamos.
They say they'll go back to picking produce in the fields to make ends meet. In Fresno, California, I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
You are tuned in to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in today. Coming up at 6:20, it is Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver of someone with this disease, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America has a helpline to provide support, answer questions, and connect you with resources. Find more info at alzfdn.org. And Stage North Theater is presenting 10 November, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. That's November 7th through the 10th at the Franklin Arts Center in Brainerd. Find showtimes and tickets at stagenorththeater.org. Mountainbikeaccess.com. Mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset will be closed November 8th through the 23rd due to deer hunting.